Hey friends, Devin again for another episode of the Bardic Babble podcast, show where we talk to creators about the things that they create. On today's episode, we have game designer John Harper, creator of Blades in the Dark and Agon. We talk about his creative process, a little bit of Blades in the Dark, a little bit of Agon, what the systems entail, how they play, specialized mechanics within the games, and things that players can look forward to. I do want to note that Agon actually just hit a global distribution as of yesterday, so be sure to head on over to your friendly local game store or johnsitch.io and pick up a copy for yourself. The design is beautiful, and I literally cannot wait to get my copy. As always, pop on over to Twitter and follow the show at Bardic Babble Pod. And then, as you all know, we're going to take a quick break, talk through some sponsors real quick, and we're going to dive right into it with John. So stay tuned. Welcome back, listeners. Today, I am joined by John Harper, the creator and author of Blades in the Dark. How are you doing today, John?
Doing well.
Good. Good to hear. So I kind of just wanted to talk to you about some of the products that you've worked on, including Blades in the Dark. I'm very new to the system, as well as some of the other ones that you've worked on, like Agon. So if you could just take a moment, introduce yourself, introduce these products, then we'll take it from there.
Sure. I'm John Harper. I'm a game designer and graphic artist. I've been working on role-playing games for several decades now. Got started when I first moved to Seattle in the 90s and have been doing that ever since. I had a long career as a graphic artist and art director and did gaming on the side. And then over the past 5 years or so, I've transitioned to full-time tabletop game designer. And the first game that was sort of the transition point there was Blades in the Dark. I did a Kickstarter in 2015 for that, and that success kind of springboarded me into transitioning fully into game design as my primary job. And Blades is a fantasy game that's set in a sort of industrialized city location that's haunted by ghosts. And you play a crew of underworld scoundrels that try to work your way up through the ladder of the underworld and succeed and dominate the other crews or whatever your goals are. So it's kind of gritty urban fantasy, sandbox type RPG. And Agon is a game about ancient Greek heroes who are lost at sea, like Odysseus style. And they go on epic adventures to try to find their way back home.
Very awesome. So we'll just start picking away at Blades in the Dark. A lot of the listeners that I have on the show are very familiar with games like Pathfinder and D&D. But something as unique as Blades in the Dark might not be on their radar. I hope it is. And if it's not, then, you know, here's a good opportunity to do that. So can you just walk us through some of the core mechanics? I believe flashbacks is one of them. Just what really sets it apart as a tabletop RPG system?
Yeah. Like you said, flashbacks are important. Blades, at its heart, is a kind of heist-oriented game. You choose your crew type when you create your characters. So you might be thieves, doing traditional kind of heisty thieving type things, but you can also be a cult or smugglers or a gang of toughs who smash and grab. But all of the action of the game centers around what we call scores, which is kind of doing a job, doing a criminal job. And to facilitate that, after running many, many campaigns involving heisty type things, including dungeons and other stuff, the planning phase of that at the table can sometimes be a bit tedious while everyone tries to come up with the exact perfect idea. And those plans don't usually last more than a round or two once you start doing them. So even though they can be fun, I wanted to try to create a system that would let game groups skip over the planning part of the heist. And one of the things that facilitates that is flashbacks. So you can say, we want to break into the manor house. We've cased the place and we know that the skylights are probably a good way in. And then you can just start. Okay, you're going through the skylight. And that can take some players off guard. Wait a minute. Wait, I need to bring the right thing. I need to plan this. I need to plan that. So in Blades, you're allowed to just play forward. And then when you hit a roadblock or there's a guard that suddenly rounds a corner or something unexpected pops up, a player can say, aha, wait a minute. I want to do a flashback to the night before where I'm at the tavern with this guard and we're schmoozing together and becoming best pals. And I arrange for him to like look the other way. I slip him some coin under the table. And you might make some rolls or pay some stress, which is sort of one of the resources that player characters have in the game to sort of push themselves past their normal limits. and the flashback's resolved. And now as you pad down the hallway, the guard kind of winks at you and you've arranged your deal. So it's a way to skip planning, but it's also a way to kind of show the prowess of the characters that they don't have to, the players don't have to think of all these clever moves ahead of time. They can wait until the obstacle appears and then come up with the perfect thing via a flashback to kind of circumvent it. And it's not automatic. There's still some risk involved and some costs involved, but
it
saves the preloading phase of the planning part.
So it's like the last 45 minutes of an Ocean's 11 movie where all the pieces are in play.
Exactly.
That's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah. That's a big inspiration. Pretty much every kind of heisty movie does that flashback thing, even if there's only one.
Right.
Of course, Ocean's 11 movies do a bunch and they nest them inside each other and stuff. But yeah, we found that very useful through the whole development process to really streamline play and focus on cutting right to the action. That's one of the sort of precepts of the game is trying to always be either in an action mode where you're in the moment doing this kind of split second stuff that's compelling, whether it's an argument or a knife fight or whatever it is, and then kind of glossing over the other stuff. So there's a downtime system that lets you sort of procedurally step through your downtime. If you want to skip over it, some groups like to really role play every bit, meeting with their vice dealer and all this kind of stuff. But if you want to, you can kind of skip past it and get right back into the next score. And some groups have found even after they played the game for a bit that they will do kind of score, downtime score in one game session. Which back in the old days, when we were actually sitting around planning, we would do one score every other session, maybe, because we might spend a whole evening just like looking at maps and discussing how we were going to do it. So that was the goal of the game, was to speed that up.
Very cool. Yeah, it sounds like a very streamlined system compared to some of the heavier D&D Pathfinder, where a lot of it's in the minutia. So you mentioned that you were doing art direction and stuff beforehand. What really just inspired you to kick off Blades in the Dark? What was the aha moment for you?
It was a combination of a lot of things. I worked on various game projects, like I said, starting in the 90s, and always through game development, you end up with dead ends and pieces that you didn't use and ideas that were good for one thing, but not for the thing you were working on. And over time, I collected all this stuff, all these notebooks and files and things of ideas and concepts. And one of them was the sort of the brass ring, the Thieves Guild Sandbox City game. Like, how do you do it? I'd run it many times using D&D and other systems and always had so much fun doing that. And then I forget when we started, probably 2012 or so, we started playing Stars Without Number, Kevin Crawford's amazing space adventure sandbox game. It uses the tools of sort of the classic D&D, the sort of OSRE, six stats and hit points and saving throws and everything. It uses those tools combined with Kevin's great sandbox tools to create a really functional, fun space adventure game where you play a crew and you take jobs. And we had so much fun playing that. But it doesn't address those things I just mentioned. It doesn't have systems in place for planning and flashbacks and things. And as we were playing Stars Without Number, we loved it, but we were running into those things again. Like, man, we're spending a lot of time. We spent two sessions planning this assassination job that we were doing, and it was it was really fun. We all like were into the planning of it, but it took forever. And so during the tail end of that campaign, I was thinking about what to work on next. I had just made a couple like short one-page indie RPG type games that I had put up on my website and was kind of getting in the mood to do something a little more substantial. And based on that experience with Stars Without Number and then looking through my notes, that idealized urban fantasy criminal crew game, I thought, yeah, okay, it's time to do this. It's fresh in my mind. I've just run 100 plus sessions of Stars Without Number, and like the whole sandboxy thing is like in my bones right now. So let's just jump right into the development and start working on this. And it was a couple years of like playtesting in my local group before it took its real shape and started to head towards Kickstarter. So, but that's typically how I work. I like to do play and iterate over like a weekly game cycle. Mm-hmm. That will quickly show if something has legs or not, or if I want to switch gears to something else. And everyone kept wanting to show up and play Blades so that it kind of earned its right to continue to exist and be developed.
That's awesome. And then how was the reception to the Kickstarter?
It was good. It was much bigger than I expected it to be. The sort of estimates of what we were hoping for was smaller. And even though there had been a few very successful RPG Kickstarters at that point, the climate was a little different back then. Kickstarter, you still had to sort of explain to people what it was.
Right.
And so I wasn't expecting a huge response to it, but I was expecting it to do okay because it had already fared well in the sort of beta release in the indie game community back on G+ when that existed. We had this like certain expectation, and then it far exceeded that to a huge degree. And a bunch of people came on board because they were excited about it, about making stretch goal products for it and adding on to it. And
right.
The Forged in the Dark core system that supports blades was also developed at that time and was being offered to other designers to use as the core for the games that they wanted to make. And some of those people came on board and made Scum and Villainy, which is sort of a Star Wars adaptation of the game, and Band of Blades, which is like a dark military fantasy campaign, plus many others at this point. But that was another sign that it was going to do okay, because there was enough interest in the bones of the game for other people to springboard off of. So it was already kind of creating a group of dedicated fans and then also creators that were excited to build off of it.
Very cool. Did you ever see a future when you guys were doing the play tests and the early iterations of people using the system in podcasts and actual play podcasts?
Kind of. That had not completely taken off really at that point. There were some in existence, and I was hopeful that that would happen, but the full integration of it wasn't on my radar during the Kickstarter in 2015 anyway. But during the post-Kickstarter development and publication phase, I teamed up with Evil Hat as the publisher. This was after the Kickstarter. They sort of approached me and asked if I was interested in them coming on board as the publisher, which I was. And they had more experience in the making sort of digital tools for play online and that kind of thing. So I had done that kind of work in my other career, but not for gaming. So we were able to find some developers, and they created these amazing sheets for Roll20 that automate everything and have these beautiful animations when you roll your dice, and all that stuff started to get developed. And that really helped a lot for the community to come together more easily and play online, especially now, obviously, like everyone's playing online. So having that stuff in place has been really wonderful.
That's awesome. How has it been overall working with Evil Hat going, 5 years now working together?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. They're great, great partners in terms of business stuff, and also Sean Nittner, their sort of director of operations there. We're old friends, and he came on board to work on Agon with me. So we co-developed that together as co-designers, and that was also a great, great experience. But just in terms of them being my publisher, it's been wonderful. I couldn't ask for a better partner.
And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but Blades in the Dark has won a handful of awards as well, right?
Yeah, it has. It won RPG, Indie RPG of the Year. There's some awards for layout and book design and other stuff like that. It was very well received.
Very cool.
In a strange way, too, because it was this sort of staggered release. The Kickstarter happened, and then there was a post-Kickstarter development phase, and then Evil Hat published it. So sort of preemptively won some awards in like 2016 or something as its publication date, and then in 2017 as its publication date, because it was kind of staggered out.
Right.
But those things, you know, in general, they're just kind of popularity contests, and I don't take them very seriously, but
sure.
It does help get eyeballs on the game. People will maybe look at something they wouldn't have otherwise looked at. And in that sense, as a marketing tool, it's always great to slap an award on something and get some attention from it.
Right, right. So now, just to kind of pivot into Agon, I'm on the product page over here on Evil Hat. I absolutely adore this cover. This is brilliant. This looks great. When did you guys? It just recently got released, right?
Yeah. The official release was yesterday, technically. Our Kickstarter backers and everybody had already gotten it.
Right.
Okay. And there was sort of a post Kickstarter pre-order phase where people had already gotten the PDF. But yeah, yesterday was the official sort of launch. It's in game stores now and all that kind of thing.
Nice. So I'm going to have to pre-order one of those real quick.
Yeah, Evil Hat, their system is really cool. I sell like the digital stuff on my Itch store. You can buy the hardcover book straight from Evil Hat, and you get the PDF for free with it.
Oh, cool.
Or if you buy the book in a game store, you get the PDF for free from Evil Hat. So they have a really great system where it kind of doesn't matter how you get it. They've got it all covered.
Very cool. And then can you just run us through Agon? Like what's the core set system and everything like that?
Yeah, it's a pretty simple system compared to something like Blades. Blades has a lot of moving parts that feed into each other and kind of fit together in this big clockwork. Agon is more a kind of core resolution system that you use for virtually everything with a couple little bits attached to it. But the main notion in the system, the thing that sets it apart, I think, a little bit, is all the heroes generally compete in contests all together. And you're facing down this shifty king who's doing something sketchy with his funeral games, and you know something's up. You want him to admit everything in front of the court, and you have a contest of arts and oration to shame him or provoke him to anger, to say so he says too much, or whatever you're trying to do. All the heroes want to jump in and do this, because in Agon, every contest sort of difficulty level of the contest equates to the glory that that contest is worth for the heroes. So the more challenging the situation, the more glory it's worth, and you track your glory on your character sheet, and over time your glory advances your character's name. Your name die is a die that you roll in all your contests, so the more powerful your character's legend and your name, the better you are at defeating foes.
That's cool.
And then it has a retirement phase in the game. There's a built-in sort of ending, and then you judge all the heroes based on the strength of their name and legend at the end, and you find out how they're remembered by future generations and things. So glory is sort of the driving force behind that system. So it behooves you to jump into contests and compete against your fellow heroes, even though you're all together on the same team against the enemy. You're competing with each other for the largest share of glory. So we had to come up with a way to sort of organize how players pick up their dice pools and when they roll and when they announce their actions. And since everyone is going at once, that can be a kind of chaotic thing. And since you're all competing, there can be some awkward situations where someone gets too excited and just rolls their dice right away and gets this huge number. And everyone else goes, I'm not even going to bother. And it fizzles out, you know. So we came up with a system where the GM, which we call the Strife player in this game, they sort of are the representation of the Wrath of the Gods and Fickle Fortune and that stuff. They roll first for the opposition to accept the difficulty number. Instead of choosing one, like in D&D, you roll to see what it is based on the enemy's stats. And then announces that number and says, who among you will face the Serpent of Nemos and its crushing grip? And you go around the table and each player has the opportunity to say, I, bronze-armed Acestus, will face the Serpent of Nemos. And when you say those, when you announce your hero in this epic way, you pick up the dice for your epithet, I'm bronze-armed, and my name die, I'm Acestus. And you might invoke a god, and I call on the daring of Hermes to help me in this task, and you pick up the die for the deity on your sheet. And then you don't say what you do. And we go around, and each hero that wants to be in announces their entrance into the contest and which gods they call on and which capabilities of their hero they're drawing from their sheet. And then once everyone's denounced themselves against the enemy, all the heroes roll at once, and we rank them from best to least. Anyone who has beaten the enemy's number is prevailing in the contest. Anyone who doesn't meet the target number is suffering in the contest, losing. And then the hero with the highest result is best and receives the most of the biggest share of the glory. And then you narrate the action after that. Once we've got all that information, who lost, who won, who's best, you start saying what you do in the contest, starting with the people who did the worst. So they get to narrate how they failed. Was it fickle fortune? Was it, did the gods interfere? Did they not have it in them to do it? You get to sort of control how your hero is presented when they fall short. Then the heroes who prevail describe how they do well in the contest and make inroads and do damage to the monster or whatever. And then the hero who's best gets to go last and put the sort of cherry on top and describe how they overcome the challenge, either putting to shame everyone else's efforts. They want to like really ridicule them and be on top, or perhaps incorporating all the stuff other people have done to lead to this crescendo where they find the weak point and finish it off.
Very cool.
So that narration thing was one of the last developments that made the game really work. And once you try it, it's one of those things that sounds kind of strange at first and weirdly mechanical. Like we're just going to roll our dice and not say anything. And then we have to wait till the end. And it's kind of odd. But once you do it a couple times, it starts to be really fun. And everyone, you could see the look in their eyes where they're just really excited to, they know their best and they're just waiting. Everyone else is saying their bits and they can't wait to just jump in and have that glorious final moment. So that's been really fun to see that final piece come together and then really click and work well at the table.
So it's super interesting, both in Agon and in Blades in the Dark. Traditionally, in D&D and Pathfinder, the storyteller, the torchbearer, is generally the DM, and you've kind of taken that torch and split it between everybody at the table and really gone for that, the collaborative storytelling element. And it's awesome to see products like that. That's what I enjoy when it comes to systems. And so when I say I'm going to go pick these up, I'm not just saying that for smiles, yeah, and giggles. It's, you know, this is the kind of thing that I look for.
We always say that with our games, they're much easier on the GM, but the trade-off is they are harder on the players. As a player, you can't sort of just show up and be like, yeah, GM, like tell your story and I'll be here too. And I'll roll some dice and I'll just like, you know, drink my beer and have fun.
Right.
These games demand a lot from the players. They expect you to like bring something, have ideas, contribute to the story, have goals, you know, and it can be a little jarring for players who aren't used to that. It's not like it's for everyone, you know, but
right.
For people who really enjoy that and want to kind of bring it. Agon less so. You don't, it's not quite as much of a player burden in Agon. That game's pretty breezy, but in Blades it is a lot. That most Blades games I show up as the GM and just look at them and go, okay, what are you doing tonight? What's your score? You know, right. I didn't prep anything. You have to figure it out.
That's fun. So what led you to Agon and the whole development process through that? Because it's a very unique, I mean, even just in the setting alone.
Yeah, the ancient world, ancient Greek myth stuff has not been done a whole lot. Not as much as you would think, anyway, in the tabletop space. I say that as Wizard of the Coast brings out their ancient Greek product at the same time. But it has been a little like overlooked, I think. And I came up with at the first edition. This is the second edition of the game. The first edition was published in 2006, and it was an attempt at making a very competitive tabletop game, like a real game that players could play versus each other and win and lose and score points. And so kind of inspired by Rune, I think is what it was called, Robin Law's game based on the video game Viking adventure game. He had developed some competitive mechanics in that, where the Viking characters were really competing with each other. And I thought that was cool. And I wanted to kind of take that to another level and really make it almost like playing squad leader or something, you know, where you're really just like competing on this tabletop against the other players. And that game was well received back then. And it had some interesting ideas in it, but it sort of peaked. And then in the years since, it sort of went into obscurity. Although there were people doing tournaments at Gen Con, I think, still every year. They were cool. Still doing these like little Agon tournaments. But when we were talking, Evil Hat and I were talking, and they said, you know, we want to do something else with you, and yet you have stuff in your back catalog. Is there anything you want to revisit as a product? And that was the first one that we talked about. Because as a designer, I could look back at that version and sort of see things that I would have done differently now.
Sure.
And as a setting, I was just really in the mood for it. I had just played, I don't know, 100 hours of Assassin's Creed Odyssey or something, and was just like really, really excited about that setting. And so, yeah, we decided to take the bones of that. There's some things that it's still from the first edition that did survive, but virtually all of it got torn out and rebuilt and or discarded. It's a very, very different game.
I gotcha.
But it is kind of a reboot or a redo of a previous project.
Gotcha. So now just looking at your itch.io, I also see a couple, looks like one page is what you mentioned. Lasers and Feelings, for example. Do you want to talk about a couple of those real quick?
Yeah. Lasers and Feelings. I think I always joke that like it's one side of one piece of paper. Blades took 4+ years and is hundreds of pages. And I think they've been played equal amounts, I think, maybe. Yeah, it's a real simple little system for playing kind of a zany Star Trek type game. You're the crew of a intergalactic spaceship. Your captain's been incapacitated by this strange force. And so the rest of the crew has to step up and deal with whatever the problem is. The GM just rolls on some random tables to determine what the problem of the week is. And then the crew responds and has a very simple system. Characters only have one number as their stat. And it's so easy to create a hack of that because the system is so simple and it's a very short word count, that right away people started to make their own sort of riffs on different forms of a Western version or superheroes or whatever.
That's cool.
I think there's like 200 some of them now.
Wow.
Saving Throw show on Twitch, they have a bunch of recorded sessions of it. They did a Fast and the Furious. They've done all kinds of stuff. I think they keep a database of all of the hacks.
That's cool.
So that's been really fun to see that get adapted and just played a whole bunch. And for classroom stuff too, that's the other really gratifying thing. Some teachers use that as a, depending on the age range, they're teaching like simple math stuff or story stuff, depending on the curriculum. But
oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's been cool to see it. Lady Blackbird is another one of my mini games that has been used in education too, because it breaks down characters into these sort of word-based, that your stats are these sets of words rather than numbers. And some classes have used that as a way for students to take the sort of Lady Blackbird character model, where you have these broad categories of who you are and these like sub categories of words, and take the characters from Crime and Punishment or whatever they're reading and write them in the form of a Lady Blackbird character to try to understand them and get into the sort of literary side of RPG material. So yeah, that's been really cool too.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So all four of the products that we've talked about, they're very highly unique. Where do you draw inspiration? Like, what other systems and designers, who are you looking at on, I mean, just on a regular basis for when you go to design?
It's harder now. It used to be a lot easier. I used to try to play everything sort of in my space just to keep up with the state of the art, and then as much outside as I could, including board games, which is obviously an impossible task. But I kind of think that my main job as a game designer is to play games. And then making them is, you know, how you get paid. But by playing, I feel like I really create those skills in myself to become a better designer and learn stuff. So in the early days of the sort of small indie tabletop scene, it was very possible to just read and play everything that everybody was making. And to this day, I'm very influenced by Vincent and Meg Baker, who make Apocalypse World and all its related games. Luke Crane, who makes The Burning Wheel. There's Stealing Cthulhu and Cthulhu Dark by Graham Walmsley that are great examples of very lightweight, simple games that allow for a lot of interesting depth at the table. Actually, Fate by Evil Hat by Fred Hicks and Rob and Lenny Balsera was a big influence on me. There's been so many indie designers that I've been in conversation with that are like part of my design community. It can be hard to untangle. I try to put at the beginning of all my games, I try to put a kind of map of influences and what games have really directly touched it. But, you know, it also is stuff like playing Root, Leader Games, their great board game, or Prospero Hall recently has released some great movie board games. Jaws and Back to the Future are both really great. And
I saw the Back to the Future one. Fun.
It's so fun. Oh man, we had a great time with that. I want all of that stuff to sort of filter through my brain and help me design. I ran fourth edition D&D and original Moldvay D&D back to back for like several years. And that was a great experience too, because I dabbled playing D&D, but it's the giant of our hobby. And I think it's good to be conversant in that space. And especially with fourth edition, because it was such a departure and such a interesting skirmish game that I still have like sub designs in my notebooks that were inspired by that I haven't made yet. But it's always hard to parse exactly where your influences are. But I always want to stay kind of have both feet, like playing through the old classics and sort of the middle 2000s classics. Emily Kerr Boss has a bunch of great games that are hugely influential, and also really trying. It's hard, very hard, but trying to stay connected to the freshest, newest thing that's happening on Itch. There's a huge design community on Itch making little small micro games, making full books. And that stuff is extra exciting, A, because they're kind of building their own design language right now. Like almost every day, new stuff is popping up. Plus, like the people making those games are not the usual suspects
right,
that have always been making RPGs. They're different voices, different backgrounds, different points of view. So that's been really cool to see too, that the diversity of thought and ideas is also broadening, as well as the design language that's being developed.
So you mentioned you got your start back in the 90s. Did you ever see a future in which tabletop RPGs, board games, were, I'm just going to call it mainstream because it is. You go into anybody's home and it's not just, oh yeah, we've got Monopoly and Yahtzee. They've got Gloomhaven. They've got Call of Cthulhu. Like, did you ever foresee as explosive of a future as it has been?
Back in the 90s, no. There were a couple mini explosions. I worked as a playtester and consultant on a couple Wizards products just before they released Magic, the first form of Magic the Gathering. And those were fairly successful for tabletop back then, which in some ways was more successful than the kind of like starter things now, because there was a smaller pool and there was an expectation that in order to do something at all, you needed to print thousands of books and like sell them at comic book stores. And so if you were doing that at all, you were probably like doing a bigger volume than your average sort of starter designer now, but they were still pretty small compared to the board game world, for instance. But then Magic came out and that changed everything. Obviously, that was such a huge phenomenon that the idea of this nerdy niche thing that was this massive global success, I think it did make people start to think that there's something here. And that kind of happened, not to the same degree, but with the launch of third edition D&D, when they kind of revamped that classic game and brought it out, and the D20 system took over and they sold a million players handbooks and like a bunch of new people came into the hobby, and that started to shift. And that was like, when was that? 2000-ish, I think, is when third edition came out. I forget exactly, but that started to plant the seed that, yeah, this is maybe going to really be something. But then after that, for a long while, everything was contained in these kind of silos of whether it was Vampire or D&D, FASA to some degree, like Shadowrun and stuff. Doing it on your own didn't seem quite so viable. Getting a job at a game company was like a track that most people were headed down. And then for me, I encountered Clinton Dreisbach and Ron Edwards and Vincent and Megan and those people at the Forge, and they were starting to do kind of grassroots stuff. And I think it was Jared Sorensen, the game designer, who first cued me into making a PDF and selling a PDF on the internet. And everything came together at the same time, like PayPal came into existence and digital distribution became much easier. And that whole avenue just opened up. And then it changed the whole landscape. Instead of thinking, well, I need to print 1,000 hardcovers and take them to Gen Con and hope they sell, or work for Wizards of the Coast or whatever in order to make a living at this, you could say, well, if I can just make my stuff at home and put them on my website and people can buy them. And it changed it lowered the bar, I guess I would say, in terms of how much you needed to clear to make a go at it. And that continues to this day. I think it's almost the default now. Like, everyone is in that space and everyone has to compete in that print on demand, instant delivery, digital play online space.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't, at least not in the last year or so, I haven't seen any Kickstarters that either A, didn't have some instant access to an Ashcans or condensed rule set as soon as you backed, or, you know, their basic entry level tier is just the PDF. And like we've mentioned, the admin of PayPal, Itch, Drive-Through RPG, all happening at one time. It's cool to see that path. As I've been doing these interviews, it's cool to see how that path has developed and led to a lot of the amazing projects like Blades in the Dark and Agon that we have today. So you also mentioned that you have a backlog and notebooks full. What is next for you now that Agon's out and circulating V2?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a variety of things. Some Blades in the Dark stuff that is in development. There was a massive amount of kind of add-on material when the Blades in the Dark Kickstarter happened. And back then, especially, it was kind of the default thing to do with your game Kickstarter was to, you know, as stretch goals and things like that, you would add on additional items and things like that. And over the years with Blades, several of those things that were supposed to be 4-page little playset editions and stuff have become their own full standalone published game books and stuff like that. So it's spilled out past its original scope. And I'm on the hook still for one of those. This thing called Null Vector, which is sort of a cyberpunk adaptation of the Blades core, which, yeah, like everybody wants it. Like, it's obvious that you heisty stuff with cyberpunk, like, yeah, that sounds right. And over the years, it's been in development. It's been this really interesting process, annoying because I want to play it. It doesn't exist yet.
Right.
But interesting process because the way, like, what cyberpunk is and the way I think about it has changed like year by year by year.
Oh, yeah.
In the literary space. And also, like, the oncoming dystopia that we currently live in, you know, colliding with the imagined one of cyberpunk and trying to reconcile where that space is anymore. Like, what is even fictional in cyberpunk anymore? It's like,
right,
come true.
Flying cars.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Flying cars. We don't have those. So that's been an interesting thing to chase and try to create spaces to play in that don't feel like the drudgery of real life,
right,
and also don't feel like so far-fetched that they're impossible. And that's come into focus recently in terms of like what it is. And I'm trying right now to really focus on that game as a one-shot engine, like a really satisfying, repeatable, dynamically generated one shot, almost like a roguelike where you play and die and respawn and go again. I'm trying to do that at the tabletop space. So that's really exciting. It's on my mind right now, my main project. But I like to have, for me, it always works best if I'm working on sort of 6 to 8 things and I can day to day kind of go where my attention is excited and develop and not feel like totally trapped in one design space.
That makes sense. I like that.
Until we get into production.
Right.
Then that's, it's different. But,
yeah. Well, that's cool. So who did the art design for Agon, now that I'm thinking on it?
I did.
All of it?
Yeah.
That's incredible. I have the player kit with the player handout here, and I absolutely love the layout and design in that.
Thanks.
What was the first game that set you on this path from Wee Young John Harper to Agon 2?
My first RPG love, kind of.
The very first.
The first one I played was Gamma World. I think second edition, maybe? 84 edition, whichever one that is. And that was great. Just zany, fun. I was like a mutant badger with a ray gun, you know, like that was super fun. But then I played Marvel Super Heroes like pretty soon after that and loved that. It was just like, I think that's what really made me love RPGs. And I wrote a bunch of hacks for Marvel Super Heroes and designed them on graph paper and notebooks and things and did illustrations and was just obsessed with them.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Marvel Super Heroes was a big one. And then Talos Lanta later on, a really obscure 80s fantasy RPG with really great art. But then I take it back. It was Star Wars D6. Yeah. Greg Kostikian's design following up on Ghostbusters D6. The Star Wars D6 rulebook was, that's what really clicked in my head. The way he wrote about the game and the way he explained the rules and the way it was presented, it was all very enticing and exciting. And it made it seem like a really fun movie that you are making together instead of an instruction manual for like repairing an engine,
right.
which a lot of game books had felt like. And that Star Wars book was just like, yeah, I think that was the one that really made me want to write my own books.
Very cool. And then did you go to school for game design, or did you go in at like principal art and stuff like that?
I did art and graphic design starting from a young age and semi-professionally and like teenage years. And I went to school to be an English professor. I thought that's what I was going to do. And I just did art stuff for fun on the side. And it over time became like that classic case where like my hobby, I'm doing more paid work doing my hobby than I am
right
pursuing my professional career. So I shifted tracks and I didn't ever get a degree or anything and didn't go to art school. I just started doing it more and more and more until that was the career path.
Experience. It's one of the greatest teachers. That's cool to hear that you were looking at being an English professor, and then here you are distributing millions of stories across the world to, you know, hundreds of
thousands. True. That's true. So, yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's funny.
It's kind of cool. So I think we'll just, we'll put a pin on it there. So where can we find you, Agon, and all of your products on the socials, on the internet, etc.?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at John_Harper, J-O-H-N, and on Itch, that's where most of my games are, johnharper.itch.io, and evilhat.com is the publisher. That's where you can get order books, and if you're in the UK or Europe, you can get Leisure Games, carries all those things, so you don't have to ship them all overseas. They're great. I know there are other retailers in Europe, but that's the first one I think of. I'm pretty active on Twitter, so anyone can hit me up there, ask questions. Happy to chat.
Fantastic. And I know that I will be heading to my game store to pick up some Agon, or at least I'll call and see if they've got it for later today.
Cool.
So thank you so much, John, for coming on, talking about Agon, Blades in the Dark, a little bit about yourself. Listeners, be sure to check out all of the products over on John Harper's itch.io. John, thank you again, and you have a lovely rest of your day.
You too. Thanks.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Bardic Babble. Bardic Babble is a part of the Bard Podcast Network's family of shows. You can find Bardic Babble and all of our other shows at thebardpodcast.com. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe for updates on new episodes. We can't wait to share the next story with you.